I can't these badges roll. See if you can get that thing lift. That's great, thank you. Well, I'd like to thank everybody who has come today to help celebrate the life of Walter Franke, who was quite a character. And after I talk a little bit, I'm going to invite people to share some of their memories of experiences with Walter, because he was a very... He meant a lot of things to different people and had many talents and things. He was quite a character, a one of a kind. And in many ways, he was a man ahead of his times. He was a hippie before there were hippies. And a real flower child in many ways. So Walter was not overtly religious, but he was a Christian. But he was very modest about his beliefs, and I know he spoke with some people they felt close to. But I'd just like to read a verse that I think he would appreciate the sentiment behind it. And where are my glasses? The dead are well informed. They look ahead beyond our bounds. On further and further still they gaze, and they must go. Their pilgrimage unfolds its length, their hostelries are planets, and the shrine they seek, the sun, where, newborn to the universe, they suffer a sun change, becoming sunlight, and like suns, dispensing light. And I think Blair would like to read a verse that... Walter shares some things with Blair, and I'll invite Blair to come up and read.
Got it. Thanks. Kind of riffing off Leslie a little bit. Walter was very understated, but he was a person of very deep, albeit at sometimes an unorthodox faith. And he and I had very extensive discussions on theology, philosophy, that type of thing, because many in this room would not know it, but I did. I have spent many years studying those things, and I'm also a person of very deep, albeit unorthodox faith. But he brought me this book one day, which is the Aquarian Gospel of Christ. And though I'm not a Christian, I did intuitively open it to just a random page in the book today, and I found a passage which I felt was the embodiment of the generosity and kindness that he carried with him. And as Leslie said, Walter was ahead of his time. But I will read verbatim. The soul is drawn to perfect light by four white steeds, and these are will and faith and helpfulness and love. That which one wills to do, they have the power to do. A knowledge of that power is faith, and when faith moves, the soul begins its flight. A selfish faith leads not to light. There is no lonely pilgrim on the way to light. People only gain the heights by helping others gain their heights. The steed that leads the way to spirit life is love, is pure, unselfish love.
So who was Walter? He was a gentle soul. He was fiercely independent, self-sufficient. And he was greatly concerned about the environment and the fate of the earth and the upcoming generations of people. He was a man of many talents. He was a horticulturalist. I know he had a reputation. He would go around helping people prune their apple trees and grafting and budding. He would go to old deserted farmsteads and collect the scions from old apple trees and bring them back and graft them onto trees at Dragonfly. So we have some apple trees there that have four or five different varieties of apples, and that's his legacy. And yeah, he was a man. He also oh dear, let me see. I'm losing it now. He also had a little nursery business at Dragonfly. Like when he arrived at Dragonfly, he began to set up a little nursery business where he sold shrubs, and he also was a wild crafter. He got to know the woods at Dragonfly so well. He would go into the woods and he'd find wildflowers, mushrooms. He knew all about the mushrooms, which ones were edible. Wealth of knowledge there. And I remember seeing him in the spring. He'd be out in his rubber boots and his bug jacket collecting stinging nettles and dandelions to eat for his greens and battling black flies. He also was a healer. He made colloidal silver, which I know it's an anthroposophical medicine, and it actually, one time he really helped me with a very bad sinus infection, and he cured me of it. And also we've brought his Rife machine, which is an electromagnetic frequency generator, which has been used to cure many things, including cancer. He was a proponent of it, and he would people would come and be healed by him, and we've had testimony from some people about how he's helped them. He was an environmentalist. He was very concerned about the impact that human beings were having on nature and the planet. And he spent most of his life in the woods. Like, he lived for 30 years on the West Coast in the woods. And, you know, a Dragonfly, he lived very close to the earth there. And I know he turned some people off with his constant pointing to the sky and saying chemtrails and spaghetti clouds, but it was a real thing. And nowadays we know wiser that he was right. He was ahead of his time in seeing what was going on. And he also was a musician. And I know he would show up at Chameleon Cove and play the tongue drum that he built, but he was a master zither player. And we have his zither here, and I guess I'll just press play. We found it, going through his things, we found a tape of him playing zither that he taped, and I believe it was while he was on the West Coast, and I'm just going to play a song. It's a tribute to what he, you know, one of his many gifts that he had. Now, Walter had Alzheimer's disease, which is a very terrible disease. But before he lost his memory, I managed to get some of his life story from him of his early life. So I'll relate some of that to you now. Walter was born in 1933 in what is called, was back then Prussia. It's Poland now, but his parents were German, so he was considered a German citizen. And, I mean, his parents were moving around at the time. 1933, Germany was under huge reparations after World War I, and there was a great deal of poverty and hunger. So he grew up in the in a lot of deprivation, like he suffered from hunger as a child. He was a third child. He had an older sister and an older brother. And then later on, he has a younger brother that was 10 years younger than him. When he was 11 years old in 1944, they were living just outside of Berlin, but he used to have to come in, take the train into Berlin to go to school. And one time when he was waiting to take the train home, a munition train blew up in this train station. His leg was broken in three places and he had shrapnel in it. He didn't have medical care for 2 days. He was put in the hospital for 2 months, and by the time they released him from hospital, Berlin had been divided into east and west. He was on the western side, his parents were on the eastern side. He was put in an orphanage for 2 months. And I'm sure an 11-year-old going through that, it would have a great impact for the rest of his life, which to me, I think it explains some of his paranoia and mistrust and you know, some of his delusions later on in life. But eventually he was reunited with his family. And I think it was difficult too, because while he was growing up, it was during Nazi Germany. Walter was left-handed. He had to hide the fact that he was left-handed because people who were left-handed were considered to be deficient and they would be sent to camps. So he had to disguise the fact that he was left-handed, and he, you know, he did manage to do that. And it wasn't until later on when he, in deep in Alzheimer's, he began to revert back to his left hand again. And I one day just said, "Oh, Walter, you're reading with your left hand." He immediately changed his over to use his right hand again. Like he just, it was so knocked into him that he had to hide that he was left-handed. So that's another thing that he carried and was very, you know, kept it quiet, but it was, yeah, it came out. After he finished high school, he did become apprenticed to in a agricultural college. Apparently his father was a professor there, and so he learned all his skills with the grafting and pruning apple trees and orcharding. And so that was his livelihood for a while. He emigrated to Canada in 1969. His older brother Helmut had come first to the West Coast, and then I guess Walter joined him. But when Walter came in 69, he didn't speak any English. So he had to learn on the fly, like the English language. And I guess he lived with his brother on the West Coast, and they were oyster fishermen. His older brother passed away, and he continued on there on the West Coast, living off the land. Like he lived on for a while on a houseboat. And there's pictures of the little cabin he lived in on the West Coast. Like he was raised, he was halfway up the West Coast and made his living. He was on the bush all the time, and no hydro, no running water. Like that's how he lived most of his life. So he came to a decision to come east because he, by then, was quite convinced that the poles were going to shift and the West Coast was going to subside in the great earthquake. And he actually used a map and a pendulum to decide where he was going to come. And that's how he chose. He was actually looking for Wallace, which is a ghost town. But the pendulum indicated that. And so he packed up his bus and came out from all the way out west. And at that point, he was 67 years old. How many 67-year-olds do you know what would do that? Go on a cross-country journey, not really knowing where he's going to land, but that was Walter. And Wayne, would you like to talk a little bit about how Walter landed?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you covered, the basics of it, which is, he came across anticipating the Earth changes. And certainly most people that are aware of that stuff know that the West Coast in particular is probably not the greatest place to be. So, yeah, he came across the country looking for Wallace, which, of course, is Sabine, which is north of Lake St. Peter before Whitney. And that's kind of where I grew up. So it was kind of interesting. But he landed at the general store in Lake St. Peter. And at the time, it was Yvonne and Philip. I don't know if people know who they were, but that's who was running the general store at the time, and they sent him up to Dragonfly, because where else would he go? And of course, I mean, immediately kind of like bonded with Cecilia around plants and stuff. I mean, that was, kind of fit like a glove. I remember watching him where the plots in front of the main house hadn't actually been used for a number of years at that point. And just watched him in a matter of a couple of weeks, like completely transform this, kind of chunk of land into, food production. Like, that was producing enormous amounts of food well into the fall, and then on top of, doing the apple trees and that sort of thing. And I at one point in 2001, I got my first digital camera, which was amazing, because before that, I mean, I still have undeveloped rolls of film. it just got so expensive. So, but at any rate, I took, all these pictures of that kind of transformation. And at one point, he started bringing up all of these, kind of like branches of trees to kind of show the impact of the chemtrails. He was, as Leslie was saying, very passionate about how, what we're doing is actually having an effect, and, trying to spread word about that and for us to wake up to what we're doing. One of the things I was going to say is that he managed to find, and I got some pictures of, lady slippers that are, I'm not going to give away the location, but Dragonfly has a couple of different patches of these beautiful, very delicate old flowers that, just to let you know. They're there, but I'm not going to tell anyone, because you'll go pick them. I was going to just say also, like with Walter, I mean, he was very intense, and that could, as Leslie was saying, sort of put people off. But I also feel like he had a great deal of grace, that there was a certain way that he was in the world that, in spite of what he was up against, and I think the last couple of years of his life, and that's where Leslie and Stu, which, I tried to pitch in as much as I could, but helping him exit gracefully. And I feel like, that's what makes my heart feel good about a very difficult last 2 years of his life, right? Where, that intense focus was lost to him, and that was difficult to see, but I'm really glad that we were able to make that as easy as possible, because that could have been a really, really, really difficult time. And so I just wanted to sort of reflect on, thank you on behalf of Walter, yes, that we were able to allow him to have a graceful exit, and that matched the grace that he had in his life. So that's
thank you, Wayne.
Well, you were part of those 2 years.
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Something I forgot to mention, he was a photographer as well. There are pictures that he took of the wildflowers at Dragonfly, but also this photograph right here is one that he took as a young man. It's his hand. It's a selfie before selfies were popular. But that was with an analog camera. It's the Swiss Alps in the background, and he managed with one hand to take a picture. And he actually won a prize for that photograph, and he was very proud of that. So that's why Stu managed to get a reproduction made, because the original was damaged. But and he actually made many things. This is his marquetry work. He made this cross. This is something he made. And he made this. This is acrylic resin, and the base, he made these things. And he did all the angles on the base, and he sanded and polished. He paid so much meticulous attention to detail. It was amazing watching him working on something. So I just wanted to mention that. That's why these things are here on the table, his Rife machine. And I did wash his hat. He didn't wash them very often. And yeah. He had a thing with mothballs too. Like, I don't know how many boxes of mothballs took out of the cabin, but we had to get rid of the smell. It was pretty intense. So I think Joe would like to say a few words as well.
Sure.
And then I'm going to open it up. Whoever wants to share any kind of experiences they had with Walter and any little antidotes or, yeah, Stu wants to talk too. Okay. Well, we'll let Joe go first and then. Okay. It's all yours.
Okay.
No, you understand?
No, I just stand here.
Okay.
I was just struck by many things about Walter and, you know, his passing. I thought, you know, we talk a lot about the skill that he has and the talent that he has, and which was all really noteworthy, you know, because as we're learning, or as I'm learning right now, there was even more to him than what I realized, you know. But there was something that was fragile about Walter as well, you know. He brought a vulnerability to the community that I thought was noteworthy, and part of my with my background, you know, it's being conscious of the vulnerability of others. I think it's that's a gift to community. You know, we get caught up thinking, you know, what we bring is our skill and our talent and our expertise, but I think we live in an era where, you know, vulnerability is sometimes forgotten. So I thought that, you know, that was something that he offered, you know, and, you know, thinkers who are wiser than me, people like Jean Vanier, talk about, you know, we come into the world weak and vulnerable, and we go out of the world weak and vulnerable. And in between, we can get caught up in ignoring the fact that we're weak and vulnerable. And I was very gladdened, you know, to see how the community around that I'm a latecomer to, you know, I've only known Walter for 10 years, and I've 12 years, and I've only been around here that long. But to see how people tuned into Walter and how they welcomed him, and he was a man looking for a safe place to live, and he had reasons for that, you know, as we're hearing. And but he came here, and people supported him, and they supported this vulnerable part of him, even though he was doing really amazing things like grafting trees and transplanting trees and making music and things like that. You know, the community really supported this vulnerable side of him. And people really tuned into it, you know. So when he started to become a little paranoid related to dementia, he thought people were, you know, poisoning him and things. But, you know, people, you know, they took that from him, and they didn't throw it at him, you know. And they just held that, and it kept them safe, you know. And I was really gladdened to see that, you know, because as a visitor to Dragonfly in Lake St. Peter. You know, and I was trying to find, you know, words to put it, you know, what I'm feeling. And one of the things that Vanny talks about, how, you know, life is a succession of crises and moments when we have to rediscover who we are and what we really want. And I think that, you know, Walter was somebody who really knew who he was, and he knew what he wanted, you know. And in a way, that's kind of his gift to all of us, I thought. So, and the other thing I wanted to mention, because I don't want to embarrass Stu and Leslie and Wayne and anyone else any more than I just did, but there's the expression that says, love doesn't mean doing extraordinary things, it means knowing how to do ordinary things with tenderness. Mm-hmm. And I thought, there you go, Mad Beaver, there you go. But thank you to everyone, you know, and Stu and Wayne and Leslie, and people that were tuned in and saying, you know, because I was a geriatric social worker, and so people would say, what should we do? What's going on? You know, like Blair kept nudging me saying, what do we do? What do we do? Because he knew he wasn't doing well. And so for years, so it was really heartening to see that tenderness that people had, you know. But realistically, my recollections of Walter was I was told that he didn't really like men, and I was a big hairy guy at the time, so I know I can be a bit intimidating. Mm-hmm. So I was very cautious around him because I didn't want to freak him out, you know. And but over time, the thing that sticks out in my mind is, you know, I'd be out trying to learn how to about the bush, and Walter would materialize. He'd just be there, you know, and he'd have his bag of mushrooms in his hand, you know, and he'd materialize, and he'd just say, hi, how are you? You know, and I'd tell him all my great plans of what I want to learn and what I'm doing, and he'd go, you know, it's like, now I reckon, but he was so genteel. I mean, he didn't laugh at me because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just having fun trying to learn stuff. So he did that. So he would show up, and you know, he just showed up one day and spent the day peeling logs with the pointed end of a shovel with me, and that sort of thing. You know, with his mushrooms, he would say, I remember, you know, he became the go-to person for all the kids. Like, can I eat this? Can I not eat this? Can I eat? And they'd bring all these mushrooms. So, well, how do you know? Is what I wanted to say. I said, do you have, and he had books and everything. So how do you know what you can eat? He said, sometimes I have a little bit first. So that was my recollection of Walter. And he had a good sense of humor. I didn't know he had a sense of humor because he was so intense about all this stuff. But you know, we were up there one day and we were getting ready to leave, and you know, I say bye, and he says, oh, long wave, short wave, microwave. So the last memory of Walter that I just share, because you know, like, there's a whole lot because he's a character, but he he, you know, he came in on the bus. Yes. You know, he came in, and I remember it was just happenstance that we were at Dragonfly, and I found this person wandering around on the south side of the road, and I went up and said, hey, how are you? You know, like, what are you doing here? Anyway, so he says, oh, I'm helping Walter. And Walter, this is about 5 years ago, maybe. So I think he's at the beginning of his cognitive decline. He had actually gotten his bus operational. He did whatever he needed to do to, like, a 40-year-old bus. He got it going. And when I was there, he turned it over. And he had packed all sorts of stuff in it. And he drove it away. And one of the wheels was locked. And the brakes didn't work. And when he had that thing just a humming, and he just forced it out of the parking lot, and there's a big gouge in the road, right? And he's going down the hill, and he's got no brakes at all. And he's going to Tom Logan's place, you know, Sunwood Farm. And then later in the day, I get to the bottom of the hill, and there's a big gouge where he just around the corner. So that was my, but you know, another instance of his fierce independence. But those are just many, many of the, I mean, just some of the things that stick out in my mind about Walter. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Stu, you want to say something?
Yeah. I want to say that Walter was a change agent. Like, his experiences in the Depression and the World War II showed him that humans can be pretty nasty towards each other and the environment. So new things had to change, and he liked growing things. He was dedicated to making things better. And change means crossing boundaries. So for change to happen, so I came across the country looking for a safe place to land. And then a dragonfly. And it's not just Dragonfly, but this whole area is a safe place for him, because we care for each other. So I'm glad he was among us, and I'm glad we're able to help him. You know, his passion alienated him from people, but here people still accepted him and took care of him. I could have known him.
Does anyone else have any recollections they'd like to share?
Walter was a visitor on our farm. As you say, he would just turn up some days. And, you know, he had so much knowledge to share with the orchard and what to do with the farm. And enjoying spending time on the farm. And some of the things I experienced from Walter were learning about Royal Rife and the frequency machine and receiving treatments. Mm. And from there, of course, we all know he was a deliverer of movies. So I also learned about Dr. Moto from Walter, if you're familiar with Dr. Moto. Messages on water, crystals on water. He gave us a film of some of his early work. And some of that work involved school children in Japan doing projects where they put a particular amount of rice in two jars and a particular amount of water and then sealed up the jars. And the one jar of the children's for this project cursed it for a month. And the other jar, they praised it for a month and gave it positive vibes. And from that, the cursed jar would turn brown, and the blessed jar would turn clear. So that was one you don't hear about Dr. Moody very much. But anyway, I decided to try that. And so one day I said to Walter, you know, I think after a year or so, I'm ready to open these jars now. You know, my negative jar is certainly brown, and my positive jar is certainly clear. Let's open them. I said, I got this theory. Maybe the cloudy one is alkaline, you know, like if health is good, you know, I just had these ideas that clear was going to be alkaline. I don't know what the cloudy was going to be. So we opened the cloudy first, and it's pink like hell now. We won't go near that. And I had some saliva test strips, and we tried the clear jar, and to my disgust, it was super acid. Mm-hmm. And I went, this isn't what I was thinking. And Walter went back to his truck and got out his slow pH monitor and stuck it in the clear jar. And it too was really acid. And I looked at it, I'm going, acid? And he looked at me and says, sewer gas. I'm going, sewer gas. And he's smelling it. And he's like, go get the Mixmaster. And so he got a bowl of water with the Mixmaster. And we mixed it for about 15 minutes. And then he put the pH monitor in again. Sewer gas, oxygen. So that's what we could explain the clear jars being oxygen. I'm like, oh, that would be healthy, wouldn't it? Anyway, that was one story. That you know, spending time with Walter was about. He also spent a lot of time with my husband, and one day they were they were grafting onto trees, and it was, you know, about 10 o'clock, maybe 11 o'clock, and they were in the orchard down by the old house, and I heard Robert, my husband, screaming, Wendy, get a ladder, help! And my mom-in-law was there, and a lot of rushing around, and I found a ladder and I brought it back. And there was my husband with Walter kind of in his arms. He says, "Oh, I thought he died in the tree." They were up in the tree grafting something, and Walter just climbed up with his floppy sandals and bare feet and had been grafting, and he passed out.
Oh,
he hadn't had breakfast and he passed out. And my husband had to catch him in the tree up high, you know, and hold him there because his feet were caught on the branches.
Oh.
And while I was running to find a ladder, he actually did, you know, gracefully get him to the ground. And as soon as he got to the ground, he looked up and he said to Robert, "I nearly passed out."
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yes,
sir.
Yeah. Anyone else have something they'd like to share about that?
Well, you did come into my place and graft a few trees.
Oh, yeah.
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 Quite a while ago. And he used to come down to my little 7 to 11 and play his drum.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was a great listener.
Oh, he was.
Okay.
Yeah. I found his zither in his bus that was parked at Sunrun Farm, and when I brought it to him, he kind of cried because he couldn't remember how to play it anymore. I think, yeah, it was
really rusty.
I think, I mean, he was so skilled in his whole journey of losing some of his capacities. I think it was hard on him because he had been so so fiercely independent. And in the last couple of years before he ended up at our house, I could see that he was struggling with day-to-day things. Like, I'd end up sometimes having to drive him to town. And I know he wasn't eating super well. I remember one week, like every day, he showed up at our door needing help. If he couldn't get his cabin open, or he couldn't remember how to do this, or he lost that. And I just said, "Well, look, Walter, you know, you can come and stay at our house if you're, if you need to. The room is there for you." And he went away. You know, and then like maybe 2 weeks later, he showed up at our door one day and said, "I need help." And I think for him to ask for help was a really turning point for him. I think he started to recognize that he needed help. And I felt very honored in a way that he took us up on our offer to look after him. And I became quite close with him the last couple of years because, he was dependent on me and Stu. He couldn't cook. He was not remembering to eat. Like, when he came to our house, he was very gaunt and gray colored, and boy, could he eat. Oh, I started cooking for him, and he ate more than soup. I couldn't believe it. But he was starving. But I think because he had experienced that before, it just was part of his life. So he kind of very gracefully accepted the help that we offered him. We were fortunate that we had a lot of support from community care. Like, we had PSW coming in 3 times a week to help bathe him, and he had physiotherapy, he had a social worker, he had an occupational therapist, and just, you know, there was a lot of support offered. I was trying to have him go to they have a day program for people who have Alzheimer's, and he went for about 2 months, and then he decided he wasn't going anymore. I just remember having him in the car, and he was not going to come out of the car. I'm not going there. He was a master of passive resistance. So I ended up taking him home again and having to scare up somebody to look after him because I had to drive to Peterborough to pick somebody up at the bus at Dana's. Oh, boy. But, he was somebody that he knew what he wanted, and that was it. He couldn't really talk him out of something. So. I there were times where he would resist and he'd resist, but then very gracefully he would, given a little bit, and then he was okay. But he when his dementia set in, I think that's when he really was experiencing a lot of paranoia and blaming other people for his misplacing things, because he did lose a lot of stuff. I found 5 pairs of eyeglasses that he misplaced. So, as his Alzheimer's progressed, he very much began to live in the moment, and he let go of all his paranoia. And in a way, it was a blessing, because he didn't worry about stuff anymore. Like, his main joy in life was, I think, getting up in the morning and having a nice meal cooked for him, and then having lunch and having a comfortable room to sleep in. And I think the toilet was still a real mystery to him, because he had spent so much time of his life in the living in the bush with no running water and toilet, that he still was very he wanted to go outside sometimes and just go and pee outside, so I let him do that every so often. But
he wanted to go up to Dragonfly once.
Yeah.
To use the outhouse.
Yeah.
I couldn't talk him out. I tried to stop him, but he kept going and trying to divert him towards the towards Linky's, and someone came along and they got to go in the car with.
Yeah.
This guy.
Yeah. So yeah, it was and I mean, it got to a point where it was we were having to provide 24-hour care, which was hard, but. We were fortunate that the transition into the manor was actually fairly easy, and he settled in fairly quickly. And I have to say that the manor, like, he was in the Cheddar Ward, which is the lock ward, they were so compassionate and kind to him. I mean, they are, with all, you know, all the times that we were there visiting, like, the way they treat the people there, it was so lovely to see. They do a wonderful job in there, and they were really... It was a good, safe place for him to be, and he got the care that he needed. And, at the end, like, he developed pneumonia, and fortunately, it was a very fast passing and painless passing, and he was really ready to go. Like, what we remember of Walter, like, that had been gone for a while, and I knew he was ready to go. He had told Wayne that he was going to see his mother soon, so... And his mother died in 88, so he knew it was his time was coming to an end, and he was very graceful about everything. So, I mean, we were very fortunate to have him in our community, with all the gifts that he had, and his sharing of knowledge, and just his gentle spirit. Like, I mean, he could be very fierce about things, but also he was very gentle, and his humor, like that joke about the... I'm not going to forget. Long wave, short wave, and microwave, like that. That was Walter.
To a T.
To a T. So, so at this point, I think I'm just going to read another verse, and then I think there. Did you want to read something else?
Yeah.
Or did you want to talk some more too?
I actually wouldn't mind a little bit of a spot to talk.
Sure.
First and foremost, Walter is my friend. Absolutely, without question or equivocation. We didn't always agree. We spoke at length on many topics that he and I may connect from completely different angles, but we always walked away buddies. I have nothing but the utmost of respect for the work that you and Stu and Wayne, to a degree, put in and caring for Walter toward the end. Also, too, it's not lost upon me that what got the ball rolling toward his care for his final days was Joe's efforts in terms of arranging, paperwork and all of the necessary stuff for that. I believe that the world was a far better place with Walter in it, but his time came. In the words of a friend of Tammy mine, who's an Ojibwe elder, you're given 3 things in this life: birth, some time, and death. And there's a lot of other stuff that can happen in between. And he managed to weather 84 years, some of it in circumstances of extreme adversity and poverty, and managed to come through and retain kindness. When I lost somebody very close to me a number of years ago, and some of you will have heard me say this before, as other people in our community have passed, but a friend of mine said to me that no one who has ever passed is in fact gone until the last person that tells their stories have passed away themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the spirit of the love and kindness and brilliance of Walter lives on as we tell those funny stories, like Joe was saying about the waves, right? As a note, with regard to Walter's sometimes perceived paranoia around the pole shifts and things like that, I have read both Worlds in Collision and Earth in Upheaval by a Russian system scientist named Emmanuel Velikovsky. They were written in the late 1960s. I have followed up on the science. It is suggested that in the course of the Earth's geological or geophysical history that the poles have shifted 67 times along the way. So his perceived paranoia on that particular topic, he was fairly studied when you get down to it. Whether that happens in our lifetime or 10,000 years from now, who's to say, right? Mm. You know, when you you get down to brass tacks. But before I choke up, I would like to read the last thing that I'd like to say to my friend as he goes back to the angels. And again, I'm not a Christian, but Walter was a very devout Christian. And I believe that he would appreciate this a lot. It's the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and then I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And I know that with his faith, that's... I know from conversation with him that that is, in fact, his beliefs.
Mm. So. Thank you, Dave.
Goodbye, my friend.
I also have a verse I'd like to read, but in closing, but I just wanted to let people know that we will be having an ash burying service at, on the summer solstice at Dragonfly, where we will put Walter's ashes and plant a tree in his honor. So, because I know there's some people that couldn't make it today, and I think it's just another way of honoring his memory, and he will live on, and all the lovely trees and things that he was responsible for up at Dragonfly. And, this is a verse by Rudolf Steiner, who is an esoteric Christian. Those who have gone through the gate of death are gazing at us. They enliven us. They are with us. Their strength is streaming down to us. So thank you, Walter, for being in our lives and bringing your kindness and knowledge. And I invite you, there's some refreshments there, including Walter's proverbial sesame snaps, which I've tried to reproduce. Not as hard as the ones he made. But so thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
You too.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, maybe just
weird. Yeah, I think it was.